NBA, Bucks and Bulls off last night. Tonight, the Bucks host Miami. The Bulls host Golden State. College basketball, number 3, Purdue. No trouble with the UW Badgers. They beat them 78-50. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Wednesday, the 17th. Sunny and windy with seasonal temperatures, a high of 23 with winds up to 20 miles per hour. Right now, wind from the west at 5. It's sunny and cold. 5 above the temperature, 14 below the wind chill. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at jackandrea.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one of our program, the co-authors of the book Treating People Well, two former social secretaries for the White House. Part two, Brody Rose, the son of frequent morning show guest Jack Rose, talks about his life's journey and how he has contended with depression. Stay with us. One of the intriguing things that is said early in the book Part one is the book Treating People Well, and these two social secretaries, former social secretaries of the White House, in a sense, come from opposite sides of the political aisle. Lee Berman was a social secretary to the White House under George W. Bush, while Jeremy Bernard was social secretary under Barack Obama. And their book is about civility, about the way we treat one another and the important place that civility can have in public life and in private life, for that matter. And it is also a book that is chock full of marvelous stories from behind the scenes of life in the White House and the role that civility played in both of those administrations. Here is our conversation. One of the intriguing things that is said early in the book, Treating People Well, is that the White House is, in a sense, two things at the same time. It is this place of sort of majestic importance in our political life, and yet it's also a party venue. I mean, it's a real place. It's a real building. I wonder if you could just say a word about how sort of keeping those two realities in balance was one of the more challenging aspects of the work that you each did as social secretary for the White House.
Well, it always felt like you were going to work, but you were also working in and out of someone's home. And so there were events throughout the day. They weren't just parties. There were press statements and press conferences, or the president might have an announcement or an address to the nation. Anything that happened at the White House, whether it's been in the mansion or in the Rose Garden or South Lawn, was the responsibility of the social office. The only exceptions were the press room and the Oval Office. So it was constant change from one event to the other. Some days we'd have four events, some days we might have one, but it became so common, in a sense, for there to be constant change that it was fairly easy to adjust to that. And it's like everyone, people have their homes and they are in part for entertaining and they are part for their living spaces that are private.
Early in the book, you write, it's not easy to keep friends on the other side of the aisle in Washington, where people's careers and success are often built on the fortunes of the political party they serve. In Washington, your politics are your living and your identity. You are from different sides of the political aisle, at least in terms of the presidency that you served. Lee, you served President George W. Bush and his wife, Laura. Jeremy, you, of course, served President Obama and his wife, Michelle. How is it that the two of you met and became friends? And what did it feel like to collaborate, in a sense, across the aisle on this book?
We met because all of the former social secretaries have kind of a loose group who meet regularly and get to know each other and offer our help and support and advice to whoever the current social secretary is, which is how Jeremy and I met. But, you know, we remain friends because the social secretaries have always understood that we want to put our best foot forward from the White House, and it doesn't matter who the president is. So we understand the need for working together. And it's part of how we came to the idea of writing the book. We want people to understand in their everyday lives that things have become too partisan in many cases, and we don't have to have politics in everything. And in fact, when we insist on injecting politics into every situation, all we're doing is making an enemy out of someone who simply has a different point of view.
As part of the book's introduction, you say the Bushes and the Obamas were more similar than one might think. What were you getting at there? What were the most important similarities between those two couples and in a sense, then, between your respective experiences and working with them?
Well, I think it, in part, that they both had families. The Bushes had two daughters, and as did the Obamas, living at the White House. And so they had to balance having a very public life and a very private life that did not make it too overwhelming or too much of a public focus on their daughters. And at the same time, they both wanted people, no matter which side of the aisle they were or what their beliefs were or where they were from, to feel welcomed and to bring as many people into the White House, especially those that had not been before. And so they both had kind of the same, very different political views, but the same outlook on how people should be treated and how they should welcome people, and we should welcome people into the House.
We're speaking with Lee Berman and Jeremy Bernard about their book, Treating People Well, The Extraordinary Power of Civility at Work and in Life. Lee Berman, you tell us that that you worked early on for actually Vice President Cheney and for a time for his wife as well before shifting over to become the Social Secretary of the White House. And you tell us that that was actually a very dramatic shift. I don't remember exactly the words, but I think it was to the effect that becoming White House Social Secretary was like landing on an alien planet. What was most dramatic about that shift, which to an outside observer might not seem to be actually all that dramatic?
Well, there were actually two shifts. I had been a full-time mom for 10 years when I went to work for the Cheneys, and I went from being in the carpool line one day to being in the White House and learning how to use White House email and the security measures required by the Secret Service and moving Mrs. Cheney and things that I'd never even thought of before in my life. And once I got that under my belt and I worked for the Cheneys for several years, I left government and I thought I was finished. And then I ended up being back at the White House working for the Bushes. And there is an enormous difference between the vice presidential operation and the presidential operation. People working on the vice presidential side tend to sort of move under the radar. People don't pay as much attention. There's not as much scrutiny. When you move over to the presidential side, then all of the staff, the women and mostly women and some men who worked in the East Wing, have to be very conscious of everything they do because they are a reflection of the First Lady. And so it changes your attitude about how you do things, and you think about things very carefully because you don't want to embarrass them or do something that would be stupid. And so that is part of why it was such a big change, and it's also much more visible.
Mm. Jeremy Bernard, your appointment as White House Social Secretary was noteworthy in a couple of different ways. If I understand correctly, you were the first male to be appointed to that position, and you were also the first openly gay person to hold that position. I think quite a lot has been said about the latter, and you're welcome to say what else you want to say about that. But in some ways, I'm even more intrigued by the first part, the fact that you were the first male ever appointed to that position. I wonder, going into the position, did you have much sense that that was noteworthy and headline news in the way that the other matter was? And do you think that made much difference in the way that you were received?
I do not believe it made much of a difference of the way I was received. I think it, because it was noteworthy and it was something that the press wrote a lot about at the time, it was a little bit more in, you know, it was a little more obvious. It was a little bit more out there. But from the moment I got in the White House, I didn't think about that. I didn't think about, oh, this is always an office that was, you know, occupied by a woman. I didn't think about anything other than putting my nose to the grind and going to work. I wanted to keep a low profile. There had been enough PR about my getting the job. Now I wanted to get the work done, and to, because it wasn't about me and it wasn't about what I did. It was about implementing the Obama's vision of what the White House should be.
One of the intriguing metaphors that you use in the book to describe the heart and soul of your duties within the four walls of the White House was when you said, we were old-fashioned beat cops. Explain what that metaphor is all about. That's certainly intriguing.
Well, the social secretary is almost like a housekeeper in someone's house, and she feels responsible for, or he feels responsible for, everything that they see that's going on. And so I would sometimes find myself standing in the diplomatic reception room minutes before a foreign state arrival ceremony saying, Mr. Vice President, you stand there. Secretary of State Rice, will you please go behind him? And lining them up, you know, like a teacher in a classroom. And they'd go out, and 1 minute later I would be down on my knees on the red carpet pulling up a piece of lint that had appeared from somewhere. Wherever there was a problem, our job was to fix it and not to waste time blaming or figuring out what happened, just fix it. And the object was to keep things as smooth as possible because we cared very much about our guests having a wonderful, memorable experience.
I appreciated the fact that you said at one point that working in the White House was not all ruffles and flourishes. And I think that's one thing that you do a really good job of doing in the book, is to, in a sense, take us behind the scenes and really acquaint us with the nuts and bolts of the work that you were doing, and helping us understand that part of what you were doing was, in a sense, to make it look easy and effortless and flawless, but the only way to do that was to work tremendously hard. I suppose that explains why people tend not to hold these positions for all that long. It has to be a grueling sort of grind, I should think.
It certainly is, and it was obviously an honor, and it was a thrill. And with that, it was also exhausting because you were kind of always on call. And but I think one of the things we wanted to really make clear was that we had the various problems. Political, not in the political sense, but there's politics in every job. And there's dealing with different people and how to deal with them. And that our experiences really are not any different than anyone else's and everyone else's that's out there working or raising a family. It's that ours happened to be at the White House, and there was a more emphasis on it or more focus on it, but that the things that we came across, the issues we found, and the things we learned are very similar to those of someone that works at, whether it be a movie studio or a corporate office or a small business, that many of the issues that we dealt with are similar to anyone else's in their job, and it for them, it's just as important as it was for us in our job.
Hmm. You outline in your book, Treating People Well, 12 hallmarks of what that really, really means. And I think a lot of people reading your fascinating book will be surprised that the list starts with confidence. Begin with confidence. And it's something you explore at great length. Explain why confidence is at the heart of treating people well.
I think it's hard to do very much in life without beginning with confidence. You know, you can't take charge, you can't radiate calm or manage conflicts if you don't have a certain level of self-confidence. And so we think that having a positive attitude and making an open-hearted approach to things is a great way to build that confidence. We also found that being very well prepared for whatever we were about to do gave us confidence because we'd spent enough time visualizing what we thought was about to happen and preparing for what might go wrong so that if it did, we could manage it quickly. And then finally, we saw how important it was to receive reassurance from the first ladies and the presidents that we worked for, and they were very good about doing that. And the reassurance gave us confidence, and then we tried to always pay that forward with the people we worked with so that they knew when we were working together and having long hours and getting kind of tired that we trusted them, we counted on them, and we knew we had each other's back.
Mm. I appreciated that this chapter takes the time to differentiate between confidence and arrogance. Because, of course, we tend to see a whole lot of the latter and maybe not as much of the former. And part of what you are talking about, of course, means understanding the difference. In your minds, what is the most significant difference between being confident and being arrogant?
I think that being confident is understanding, feeling good about the job you do and that you're capable of doing it, and understanding that it is not you alone and it's with other people and that you are part of a team all working together. Arrogance is the feeling of the overconfidence. Arrogance is the feeling that I'm the best at this, I can do it on my own, and I don't need anyone else. It's so easy to detect. It seems like it would be a fine line, but it's so easy to detect in someone that is confident and someone else that is arrogant. And so they're both kind of start at the same place, but one goes way, way further in overconfidence in becoming so full of oneself that you don't build confidence in others. The only thing you do is build yourself up, whereas real confidence, not just is confidence in yourself, but building it in other people and making them feel confident.
Right. That reminds me of the story, Lee, that you tell about the moment when First Lady Laura Bush decided to entrust you with approving the daily menu at the White House, something which the chief usher told you had not been done in recent memory. And that was such a powerful gesture of confidence in you.
It was, and it built such great loyalty in me to her. I was so surprised and grateful. It showed that she trusted me, and it showed other people on the staff that she trusted me. Because, you know, the White House resident staff is a bureaucracy. They are wonderful people who stay through each president. Many of them have multiple generations of family members who serve in the White House. And any organization like that has a way of doing things. So a new person coming in might not always be listened to the way someone who's been there and been more established. And by showing her confidence in me, she helped the rest of the people that I worked with every day to see that it was okay to trust me and it was okay to listen to what I was asking them to do, because they weren't really requests for me. They were requests coming from her through me.
Hmm. One of the points on this list of 12 involves humor and the fact that humor can often be a very important factor in making situations better and can help us make us more resilient and better at handling challenges. Jeremy, you especially spend a lot of time talking about the way in which you used humor. And sometimes I should think in fairly daring fashion from the way you describe it. Just say a word about what a powerful tool humor was and what a tool it can be when we use it well.
Humor, in that again, is another example of where confidence is so important, because you need to have confidence in having the humor before you can go out there and feel like you're going to be humorous if you're not confident about it. But I think that it is really a key to putting others more at ease, especially in a tense or a stressful situation. And I saw my father, as I was growing up, use humor at difficult times to ease a certain tension. He wasn't making fun of the situation or belittling it, but it made everyone feel a lot less tense. And it's one of the things I found most effective, both with my staff and with the president and first lady. Now, I was lucky. I'd gotten to know the Obamas at the very beginning of the campaign in 2007, so I had a comfort level with them. But I think it's no matter what workplace and what situation, you have to read it well and know that it's what you're saying isn't going to be offensive, but that self-deprecation especially is often a way to make people feel more at ease.
Right. I wish we had more time. I want to spend our last minute or so talking about what I am probably thinking about the most out of your whole book. It's when you talk about your fourth point, listen first, talk later, when you write, "We live in a world of constant communication, but lackluster learning." What is your advice to help all of us, whatever we do, even if we don't live in the White House or work in the White House, how can we do better in listening with care?
I think we all need to slow down. I'm not sure that many of us realize this, but our brain moves so much faster than someone speaks. So if you're standing there talking to your boss and he's telling you something he wants you to do, while you're listening, you're also thinking, here's what I'm going to do. Here's how I'm going to respond. I wonder what I should have for lunch. And I really have to get to the dry cleaners after work. And it's very hard to focus in because our brains work so fast. So if you can discipline yourself a bit to slow down and just listen to what someone is saying, give yourself a chance to think about it before you respond. And, you know, pausing before you answer is just a matter of showing some thoughtfulness, and then answer and take your time. We don't need to race through life as we do because we miss so much. And when you're trying to have real communication with someone and really build up a relationship, you have to listen. You have to look between the lines and see that, you know, perhaps they aren't saying exactly what they mean, but they're hoping that you'll figure out what they really mean. So it just takes a lot more attention.
Well, you certainly had great role models, both of you, in the way you were listened to by the respective first ladies with whom you worked. And your story is just full of amazing accounts of all that you did and experienced in your time in the White House. The book, again, is Treating People Well, The Extraordinary Power of Civility at Work and in Life, published by Scribner. The co-authors, Lee Berman and Jeremy Bernard. I thank both of you for writing this fascinating and inspiring book and for joining me today on The Morning Show. I was honored to speak with you.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us.
And the time is 8:33. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and here is part two. I am really pleased to be able to spend this portion of WGTD's Morning Show with a young man by the name of Brody Rose. And in some respects, I feel like I already know Brody, even though I just met him scarcely 5 minutes ago. But Brody Rose is the son of Jack Rose, who is one of my most frequent morning show guests. And many of you know Jack Rose for the tireless work that he does on behalf of the local chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance of Mental Illness. And Jack Rose has two children who have contended with mental illness of one kind or another. In the case of Brody, it was debilitating depression. And Brody, fortunately, has come an extraordinarily long way in terms of in a sense, gaining control of his depression or handling it in a sense that it no longer debilitates him in the way that it once did. And he is living a happy and successful life, and also, among other things, does something that has led him to be known as the Coaster Doodler, in which he creates wonderful and imaginative artwork, always involving coasters that, as in roller coasters, that are inserted into photographs or illustrations that already exist. It's absolutely amazing, and we're going to talk a little bit about that as well. Brody Rose, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. That was a very heartfelt introduction. Seriously, I was smiling the whole time and never heard it. My you know, experience putting those words or that way. And
well, I hope that was at least somewhat true.
Spot on. Great.
So I remember your dad describing you as an active and great young man who was busy doing all kinds of things ahead of when depression kind of entered the picture. What were you like? What was life like? What were you busy doing, and what made you happy?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I had a very, very happy childhood, very active, always playing sports, big into football and soccer and basketball, and very active, very thankful for my childhood. Always had a really good core group of friends, dating back to when I was in elementary school, that I still have.
Wow,
today.
After all these years. And this was, I believe, out in Washington, D.C., is that right? Is that where you grew up?
My dad was in the military, so we were out and about, and around, but mainly on the East Coast between Florida and then Alexandria, Virginia, and just a really positive experience growing up.
Mm. At what point did there begin to be signs of depression? And were these signs that you first noticed, or that the people around you first noticed?
Everything was great, more or less, all the way through college. And so I had this very active lifestyle on a daily basis. I was fortunate enough to run track at UW-Madison. Which was terrific. But more or less, growing up, I had a lot of things to do on a daily basis that I enjoyed doing, more or less a schedule that, kept me happy and productive.
Right.
And
right.
More or less graduated, didn't really have a plan, you know, after college, and all of that came to a screeching halt as far as my daily routine.
So when you got done with college, suddenly the days sort of emptied out for you, and you didn't have any of that framework anymore.
Absolutely, 100% true. I think track coming to an end was a pretty big part of it as far as how a positive force that exercise can be, and that was something I had done 22 years, and all of that, no more practice, not only where I was exercising, but just the camaraderie of doing that with my teammates, so.
So all those connections, or at least in terms of the daily connection, kind of went away.
Absolutely.
And that's when these symptoms first then started to emerge.
Yeah, more or less, yeah.
Can you describe just how serious we're talking in terms of the way in which, in a sense, you changed and your outlook changed?
A 180 degrees, complete change. And, you know, it doesn't happen immediately. It's a slow drain. Hmm. Over maybe, I don't know, 3 months, I went from a very happy, accomplished college student, right, to just absolutely no self-esteem. The happiness that I maybe took for granted was no longer there. Hmm. Over a 3 month stretch.
Did it get to the point by the end of that where what we sometimes hear about, where somebody can scarcely leave their apartment, scarcely leave their bed? I mean, were you debilitated to that extent that you could hardly function?
Yeah, well, that was after this was before I knew anything about depression. I didn't really know what was going on. I knew that, it was scary, you know? I no longer had a passion for life, which was very hard to handle. Because, like I said, just always really enjoyed everything about living.
Yeah. And suddenly you enjoyed nothing about living.
Not even correct. Looking back at it or thinking about it now, oh, yeah. I was having depression, but it didn't come to me until it got bad enough where I had to talk to somebody, right? Mm. And I was able to talk to a close friend of mine, and she was the first person to tell me that it's not my fault, and something is, you know, wrong, something that can be treated, or at least discussed. Mm. And that was comforting in the sense that she kind of opened my eyes to a path of returning more back to normal, more or less. And that's when I first learned about there's professionals who deal with this kind of stuff.
So this has never been part of your life before. So you had no reason to understand what depression was. You didn't even understand that there are people out there whose life's work is to help people who are in depression.
Right.
And I'm sure that had to be the scariest part of it, was in the early going when you had no idea what was wrong.
Yeah, it was very, very scary. Mm-hmm. And just at the same time, it's just kind of a numb feeling. You're emotionless. Mm-hmm. And I was, I know my father works a lot with suicide prevention and awareness. I was never suicidal, but at the same time, I was not going to complain if something happened to me.
Wow.
You know, it was
kind of semi-suicidal, maybe, in a sense. Yeah.
I was not scared of dying, which scared me because until then I was always terrified of the thought of death and not living anymore.
Life was so good for you till then.
Yeah.
One thing, of course, that sometimes makes mental illness of any kind such a serious problem in terms of someone getting treatment is that in many cases, especially when someone is an adult, you yourself have to say, okay, I need help, give me help. But if your own perception is so compromised by whatever that mental illness happens to be, in many cases, you're not in a position to say, I have a problem, can you help me with it? I suppose you're really fortunate in that you were at a place where you still had enough of a grip on reality and an understanding of who you used to be that you were willing to seek out help and receive whatever help people could give you.
Absolutely. I was shaking my head or nodding yes and up and down the whole time you were speaking. That's absolutely true. So it's, you know, okay, fine. I knew something was wrong with me, but unfortunately, just coming to that realization and telling someone is only, it's a very important part of the process, but just scratching the surface. Mm, it's not like that here. Yeah. It was, you know, the beginning of my ability to cope with this.
Mm. How long a process are we talking, and what ultimately?
It's still going.
Well, right. It's not that we shouldn't pretend like a light switch finally got flipped off. Depression is still a reality for you. But what has made the biggest difference for you in terms of being able to come to grips with this and not let this be such a powerful force kind of undermining the way you're living? What's made the biggest difference in you being able to kind of rise above this to the extent that you have?
I guess the first thing would have to be communicating and expressing myself. In my case, I feel very fortunate because I have, like I said, very close friends who I feel comfortable enough, you know, having a conversation with them about it. Also, my parents, as you know, are great. So I have the best, like, support group you could ever have, and I can't imagine not having that. And I know that's like, let's say, you know, my life was different and I was homeless, right? And that would have been the end of me.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so you were fortunate that you had a circle of support around you who were really giving you
absolutely
tremendous help.
And then of course talking with a professional, but so there's, you know, there's cognitive therapy as well as you know, medication. And it's not a pill that you take and it for a headache, right? And it, a couple hours later, it's gone. The medication for me has definitely helped, but just with the medication alone, it wouldn't have cured me. It wouldn't have gotten me back on the right track.
So that's just part of a bigger picture.
Definitely. And so, backtracking a little bit, been dealing with this for 17 years. Like, this was 1999, 2000, when I graduated from college. And believe it or not, it's almost 2018.
Mm.
And there's been, you know, there's been ups and downs. And there was a point where I thought I was in a place where I didn't need to see a psychologist or medication, and it wasn't something that I did drastically. It was just kind of a progression, and you know, the doctors were aware, or whatever. You know, it wasn't anything where I cut myself off immediately and said I'm all better now.
Mm.
Yeah, but then a few years after that, I had noticed, and this was 2009, 2010, where I kind of noticed like something was not feeling right, and that's when the whole coaster doodler thing came into play. And I talked to my wife about it, and she's always been more or less understanding. I know it's not, if you've never dealt with or experienced depression, it's really hard to comprehend what that person is going through.
Right.
But she does a great job of it.
Hmm.
So I ended up saying I got to go see a psychologist and a psychiatrist again, and just kind of touch base. And then I was put on another light dose of Zoloft, which I've been taking for the past 7 years.
Mm.
And just a minor dose. And, you know, I go in every 3 months and talk with the psychiatrist and make sure everything's cool.
Mm.
But I don't want listeners to think like that was the answer to all my problems.
Right.
It's just a small little sliver of something that has been beneficial to me.
Right.
And another thing that I started doing was the coaster doodles.
What was the first time you did this? That is, started doodling on a photograph or an illustration, doodling a roller coaster to sort of embrace the illustration. When's the first time you did that?
That was 2010 when I started to know, when I started to get treated again for depression. And I just kind of started a job that was, any job. It didn't really matter what I was doing. It would have caused anxiety to have to get out of bed and do it.
Right, right.
And it was it's a creative firm that I still work for. But the doodling was a kind of a way to get my engine started in the morning.
Mm.
As far as, you know, very similar to crosswords or Sudoku or
right.
And so this combined something that I loved as a child, you know, as a kid growing up, and I still do today, as roller coasters and drawing them. At the same, a combination of a commute that I had to take to work, you know, so I had more or less 30 minutes sitting on the metro train commuting every day, right?
Mm.
So it was finding use of that, and then all of a sudden there was this kind of like structured time where I didn't have anything to do. I needed to find something to do. I hadn't been sketching or drawing in a long time. I'm a graphic designer, so I was on the computer for a long time, and I hadn't done like hands-on art and creative spontaneous creations. And I remember making a point of that. Like, I got to start doing something off the computer and just kind of for my own entertainment.
Right.
And then the metro ride was often a very high anxiety trip for me.
Hmm.
Because it's kind of like any other thing that you have anxiety about until you start doing it. Once you start doing it, it's fine. Right. Like even this interview.
Right.
And often like track as well. You know, you're super nervous as soon as the gun goes off.
then you get to do
everything's
it.
Back to normal.
Right.
I needed something to do to prepare me mentally to be in a creative environment.
Hmm.
And this little spark of doodling and creating, what was the answer for me.
Hmm.
And then it became like an addiction.
Yeah, you know, right.
I had to do it every day, and it was something where it wasn't a blank sheet of paper that was intimidating that I had to create something out of the blue. It was flipping through the paper, seeing something that inspired me. I want to see a roller coaster, and I want to see it right there.
Right.
I want to see it.
And that's an interesting point, that you're not starting with a blank sheet. You're starting with some kind of image,
yeah,
and then adding a roller coaster to it. So, for instance, the morning that we are doing this interview, the front page of the Kenosha News is a picture of the Pleasant Prairie power plant. They have just announced that this power plant's going to be closing, and so there's a big photograph of this power plant, and you have drawn around it, so it sort of encloses it or embraces it almost, a huge roller coaster. And
The headline actually says power plant to close, roller coaster to open.
There you go. And it's just amazing. And I've seen a booklet that collects some of these, and I went on your Instagram account and looked at some more of these images. They are so impressive. Are you trying to do something in particular when you create these, or is it purely for fun?
It's definitely for fun. Maybe it's a little off, but it's make believe, right? But at the same time, I think I have too much respect to roller coasters and physics and the way they work that I try and make them somewhat realistic as far as them being able to actually operate.
Right. No, I mean, I absolutely agree. There's something so fanciful about it, and yet also that looks. What you've drawn on this photograph, that looks like a real roller coaster. It looks like the right scale.
Right.
It looks like it actually, if you put a car on that roller coaster, it would actually work. And I think that combination of realism and whimsy is absolutely delightful. And I'm glad too that it's something that gives you some pleasure. It sounds like it sort of settles you down, prepares you for the day, and And we all want that. So I think that's a great idea. So now all these years after, you are continuing to function well and keeping the depression, at least for the most part, in check. And we're so happy to hear that as well. In closing, I wonder if you just have a word to say about your dad, whose voice is so familiar to our WGTD listeners, and about the work that he does on behalf of NAMI. I suspect that you are really proud of him.
Yes, very proud, and I know got to wrap things up, but you know, when you started to introduce me, it's just kind of amazing to see how my struggles kind of influenced him. Because both my mom and father had no experience with depression as far as education and knowing what's going on with our son. He has depression, you know.
What is that? Yeah.
So going from that end of the spectrum to where he is now and what he's doing for NAMI and educating himself and both him and my mom, and then being such a force in this community as far as reaching out and acknowledging that this is a big problem, and it's not a physical one, in the sense that you know, a broken arm or something that you can see someone has a cast on. You know, no one would guess that I have, you know, a mental illness, which is
right.
You know,
just to look at you, no, you look like a perfectly normal, strapping guy, but there's this thing inside, and all of us need to come to a greater awareness about that. And I agree with you. Your dad has done an amazing job, first of all, of educating himself, and then of doing so much to educate the rest of us on what this is and what all of us can do together.
One last thing is, you know, maybe, you know, it's a blessing in disguise, you know. At least that's the way I kind of like to look at it, is what I went through. It's allowed my father to help countless of others.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah, I think, I mean, your dad would not, you know, wish your suffering on you or anybody.
Right, of course.
But on the other hand, you're right, a lot of good has come from it, and that's an important thing to acknowledge. So, well, I am so pleased to meet you after all of these years, and after hearing something about your experience, to hear it from you directly has been great. So we wish you much happiness and success in the future, and more happy doodling as the Coaster Doodler. And Brody Rose, I thank you again for being part of the morning show today. Very, very best wishes to you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we will be previewing for you the upcoming performances of the musical Rent by the Lakeside Players of Kenosha at the Rhodey Opera House. We'll be speaking with the stage director and music director of this production of Rent, one of the great important works in recent Broadway musical history. And on Friday's morning show, I am excited to be speaking with Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College. Our conversation will occur on the eve of the one-year anniversary of the inauguration of President Donald Trump. So we will look back over the last 12 months at what has happened, what has not happened, the means by which President Trump has been governing, the way politics has been functioning in Washington, D.C., in some quite unprecedented ways, and what is likely ahead for the president. That will be on Friday's morning show. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad.